Welcome back to class number 15, those of you who have made it this far. I think we're going to discuss God Who today. It's not an owl call, it's something else, as we'll discover. I wanted to follow up, though, on a few things from last time, because we have actually finished the entire first part of the book. So, the first part, as I'm sure you all remember, dealt with deconstructing certain common ideas, especially common Christian ideas. So I just wanted to list a few of these so that we can remember what they are. First of all, we learned that the New Testament was not written in Greek. Then we discovered that, in fact, there was no such thing as the New Testament, or the Old Testament, for that matter. There was no such thing as the church. No religious offices, like bishop, deacon, or so forth. Then that the Jews did not reject Jesus. In fact, most responded positively. By the way, on that note, I saw recently someone's Geneva Bible, which is the 16th century Bible that was popular before the King James Version. And just in a typical passage of the Gospels, it was describing large numbers of Jews responding positively to Yeshua, but some of the leaders being very angry with him, and the heading that was added in large letters in this Geneva Bible, which was the Bible of Shakespeare and Bunyan and others, was "The Jews Reject Christ." Mm. So it this has operated on many levels. It's been part of the culture for a long time. It's perpetuated in all sorts of different ways. But anyways, we discovered that that wasn't true either. In fact, corrupt Jewish leaders serving Rome had the Messiah killed. We looked at how Christians are not the biblical people of God, and then the fact that there aren't even any Christians in the Bible. The idea that Sunday is not a new Sabbath, nor the Lord's Day. And on this, Bobby and some others noticed articles that were very relevant. I sent that out to you. This one on Sabbath versus Sunday in WorldNet Daily was very interesting, and I just wanted to read you a portion of it because it relates to the word sabbaton that we discussed a few times. If you remember, there are a couple places where it says something about the first day of the week. Well, what this article points out is something that we noticed in class, which is that the week there is actually the word Sabbath. And so one of the translations, the word-for-word translation by Brown and Comfort, published by Tyndale House, renders it instead of on the first day of the week as on one of the Sabbaths. So even those places that talk in the Gospels about possibly meeting on the first day of the week, whether it's in the evening or in the morning or what have you, might actually be a mistranslation itself. It might be better rendered as simply they were gathering on one of the Sabbaths.
Wow.
Interestingly enough. I hope you had a chance to read that article. It was pretty thorough. Interesting. Did everyone get it, by the way?
I didn't notice. I got an article, but I don't think it was that one.
Yeah, I got a different one.
Yeah, me too.
Hmm.
I've had a large email.
Maybe I sent the wrong article. Did it have to do with Sunday and the Sabbath?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, they did. They had two different articles. Mm-hmm. Maybe I sent the wrong one. I can go look and maybe I'll have to send
the first one. Was the one that said should we be one or the other, and the second one was Christians defending Sunday.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the one I got.
Oh, really?
I think so.
Christians defending Sunday.
Okay, maybe I sent the wrong one, but they're related, so I'll look and maybe I can send the other one out too. In any event, after that, we looked at the question of where we're headed, and we discovered that maybe we're not really headed for heaven, because God's kingdom is coming to the earth. And then finally, that there's no religion in the Bible. So where has all of this taken us?
Into confusion.
I would say, yes, maybe into the wilderness, which is a theme of the first part of part two. But that could be a good thing. Isaiah 40 says, "A voice is calling, Clear the way for the Lord in the wilderness. Make smooth in the desert a highway for our God. And so I think that part of the way my father presents part two of the book is as building a road in the wilderness where no one usually goes, where there are issues that people don't usually think about. And that's clear in this section on rebuilding the highway, which we can read in one moment. Just one other thing before we go on to that, though. We had also looked at the word Greek itself and how it has various meanings. Does anyone remember that discussion?
A little bit, from Romans 1:16.
Okay, that's part of it, yes. But I mean just the word Hellenic or Greek, as used in the Messianic writings, can have more than one meaning. It doesn't usually refer to ethnic Greeks.
Right, it's just anybody not Jewish.
That's one meaning. It could sometimes it refers to people who are not Jewish, Gentiles. What's another way in which it's used? If you remember.
Maybe a different philosophical system?
Yes, people who have adopted Hellenic culture and thought, whether Jews or non-Jews.
Correct.
And sometimes it's even used for a particular kind of Jews. Like in Acts, is it 6 or 7, where it talks about, Acts 6, where it talks about the Hebraic Jews and the Hellenic Jews, the widows complaining. Mm-hmm. So that's the same word. So the word that we translate usually as Greek actually has the same problem of different meanings as the word that's usually translated as Jew. But the difference is that the translators generally tried to correct this. In other words, if you look at all the places where that word appears, Eleinoi, you will see that they translated it in different ways. So sometimes they translate it as Gentiles, sometimes they translate it as Greeks, sometimes they translate it as Hellenic Jews. So they understood that that was going on. Now maybe they were not always correct in their interpretation, but they understood the process that was taking place. And they translated it accordingly. Now, the same thing is evident with the word Iudaioi, which is usually translated Jew. But there, the translators didn't do the same thing. There, they always translated it Jew, and that's what led to a lot of the problems that we described. So I just wanted to clarify that point, in case it wasn't fully explained. All right, well, Pesach is coming up, and we'll be reading from the Haggadah soon. So I think maybe we should take this opportunity to prepare ourselves by going around and reading the story. We can just maybe read one paragraph each if the paragraph is very short. Or let's say maybe two or three paragraphs each if they're short paragraphs. So, Bobby, do you want to start?
Rebuilding the highway. I have a Jewish friend who was born in Poland. When she was 10 years old, she was taken from her family and put into her first of several Nazi camps. When she came out 5 years later, everyone in her family, except for one sister, had been killed. After the war, she came to live in the United States. A few years ago, I took her back to Poland for her first visit since then. We went to her hometown, to the property that had belonged to her family. Some wonderful Polish friends took us everywhere. We knocked on the door of the house. Someone else was living there. The woman became very nervous when she found out who Rose was, because under Polish law, Rose could legally reclaim the house and the land and all that had belonged to her family.
Rose was not interested in doing that. She just wanted to see what had been her home. It was familiar but strange. It was no longer her home. Not far away was a new synagogue. The Jewish community had finished building it in 1939, months before the Germans came. As we stood on the balcony, Rose had found memories of her sitting there with her grandmother. She recalled watching the service take place down below.
All that was left were the brick walls. No windows, no doors, no furniture, no ark, no Torah, no Jews. Nothing except the trash that people dropped as they took a shortcut through the building to get to the street on the other side. As we stood there, a man walked through the sanctuary and spat holy spit on the dirty Jewish floor. We went to the Jewish cemetery where her father had been buried. Before the war began, he had been attacked by Polish anti-Semites and consequently died of a heart attack. The Jewish cemetery was small, bordered by a large Christian cemetery. Rose kept searching unsuccessfully for her father's grave.
She stopped, looked around, and tried to figure out why she couldn't find it. It had been 60 years since she last visited his grave. Then she realized that what had happened. Two-thirds of the Jewish cemetery was gone. It had been swallowed up by the larger Christian cemetery. Her father's grave had been in the area that had been taken over. Two-thirds of the Jews buried in the Jewish cemetery had been dispossessed and kicked out. As for Rose's father, even his grave had been taken from him, so that a Christian could be burying it.
The years that followed the war were very difficult in Poland. The war had brought great destruction, and people were very poor. The Soviets oppressed and exploited everyone. People survived however they could. They took the houses, farms, and businesses that had belonged to their Jewish neighbors. After all, the Jews were no longer there. The Jews no longer needed what had belonged to them.
In finding inexpensive ways to build, some of the Polish people of Rose's hometown put the Jewish tombstones to new uses as paving stones or as foundation stones. After all, the Jewish graves were no longer there, and if they had been there, there were no Jews to come visit them. I cannot express what Rose felt when she realized all this. I cannot express what I feel when I see how the church has dispossessed the Jewish people of everything that is rightfully theirs. I cannot express what I feel when the church calls holy what is unclean and abominable and spits on what is holy. I can, however, do something about it.
In Isaiah 62, the Lord speaks of the steps necessary for the redemption of Israel. I want to speak a little bit about one part of one verse, verse 10. Prepare the way of the people. Build up the highway. Once there was a highway that God built. It was a highway that led from every corner of the earth to Jerusalem. It was the redemption of Israel and the salvation of the nations. God is rebuilding that highway. In the Messianic age, all the nations will travel on it. All the Jews will rejoice in it. I am working on rebuilding one section of it. People ask me, what is the relevance of what you are saying? What are the practical implications? But I am working on rebuilding a highway that no one thinks they need. It is a highway in the wilderness, and no one is traveling on it. No one is interested in it. For many centuries, the road has been declared closed and dangerous. Everyone has been warned. Trespassers will be prosecuted.
People have built countless detours that go off in countless different directions. Some of the detours wind around and up and down and finally arrive more or less in a place that is not totally removed from the original destination. Some of the detours go to dead ends, and the detours have detours, and those detours have detours too, and usually people get lost. They never get where they are going. They don't even know where they are going, but they have canonized the detours. Epicycles on epicycles on deference on eccentrics, all to preserve a system that is not right. It has never been right. It has always been wrong. These detours have been built over Jewish graves, paved with Jewish tombstones. But the historical and theological voices cry, why not? The Jews are gone. We have needs too.
Yes, you have needs too, but God has made provision for you. God has made a way for you. You don't need to take as your own that what belongs to someone else. Besides, Jews are not gone. The Jews are back. These were our lands. These were our houses. These were our graves. These were the things that God gave to us. We do not intend to dispossess you as you have dispossessed us. You may humbly share equally in the inheritance, but we do intend to take up our identity and call in our calling. That you cannot have. If you understood what these things really were, you would not be rushing to claim them for yourselves. The calling of Israel is for your benefit. Don't impede it.
Well, does anyone have a burning thought after reading that passage?
I'm going to Sar El. We're going to build up the land. It's very Zionistic.
Yes, it sounds that way. Do you think it's talking about Zionism here, mostly?
Not in general, no. It's talking more from a spiritual point of view.
Okay. So what would be the spiritual equivalent of going and volunteering for Sarel?
I think that we believe that God gave Israel to his people. Serving Israel, you're serving, you're serving his people and you are serving him.
Mm-hmm.
That's one, maybe.
Right. So even Sarel might be a spiritual service, mm-hmm. certainly. If you had to pick one word to describe this little story here, what adjective would you use? Or maybe a noun or something.
Sad,
okay.
Holocaust.
Okay.
It's just part of it.
No word really touches it. Violation.
Yeah.
I think hopeful. Because if she goes through and says, we won't dispossess you, you know, but don't impede God.
Mm-hmm.
We are hopeful for what God has in store for us, and we have to get there in that sense. So I see, especially the ending, as being very hopeful as it's moving on in the direction of God, which God wants it to move.
Mm.
Do you think it's provocative?
A little bit.
That stirs the heart, certainly.
She is not after, the woman was afraid that she was after the possessions. And this is like, the possessions are not important.
Right.
It's people.
You've taken our spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's important.
Yeah.
You asked for one word, but I got two.
Okay.
Well, I thought daunting task. I just feel like, yeah. Oh my goodness, mm. We have so much to undo now.
Yeah.
I think that when your father's like looking at it from a spiritual point of view, and he's saying that the church has taken things from the Jewish community, I think that if you look at it in a wider point of view, you could say that Western civilization has a tendency to take things away. They tend to be, part of the culture is to colonize, to take over, to dispossess people. It's not just a Jewish thing, it's a cultural thing. They go into different countries, they make colonies, they take over, they claim land, it's just, you know, for the queen and the king and whatever, and they just mm-hmm. take and take and take.
Mm. Russians were not Western.
Yeah, that's true, and they did the same thing.
Maybe it's a universal human thing
mm-hmm.
to want to take things for yourself, mm-hmm. but certainly there was something about Western civilization that, you know, promoted this kind of colonization all over the world at a certain point in time.
Mm-hmm.
Most of Russia's colonization was expanding in ways contiguous with its boundaries,
mm-hmm.
but most of the European powers sailed all over the world mm-hmm. to get whatever territory they could.
For profit.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also within their stuff, the honor, like she was questioning, she was talking about the graves and this just happened in our family where you used to honor the dead people and the graves were there forever and it was a family thing. And in Europe, now the graves are a 20-year lease.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And
wow.
So after 20 years, well, you have to pay for them for 20 years. You lease the grave for 20 years and after 20 years, it goes, it gets flattened. So, you know, all these old graves are not there anymore after 20 years. Everybody.
Hmm. Now, one of the things that we've always done when we've gone back to visit your family is the first place you always want to stop is your parents' grave.
And
now it won't be there.
Hmm.
Wow.
Can't you pay?
Well, no, but her brother and was left in charge of it, and he decided that he didn't want to be bothered with it anymore. It was too much.
Hmm.
Because they don't just, it's not just like a grave like it is here. I mean, they keep flowers on it. And it's very, I thought we walked into a garden center. I didn't realize this was a graveyard because it's very beautiful. And so I'm imagining what it must feel like for this person to go back and not be able to find their grandfather's grave mm-hmm. when I know what it's like for her to go back and she no longer has a grave to go to.
Yeah, her father also in this story, Rose's father, she mm-hmm. wanted to find his grave.
Well, Rose came to speak at Son of David once. What was her last name?
Price. Yeah.
Price, okay.
Oh.
Was Price her real name?
Well, that's her married name. Okay. I don't know what her maiden name is.
Okay. I thought in another word, but it's in Spanish. I thought in destierro. It's like if I can give a, like, kind of try to give a meaning, is like when you take somebody by force from his or her land or their land, you know. And in terms of this, I believe that it wasn't something just like physically moving people, but it was it's something like moving, trying to move the foundations of the Word of God to our own desires, you know, mm-hmm. our own perspective or interpretation, you know.
Convenience.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a way to fix that?
Going back.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I need to go back. And I think a large part of what this book shows is that in order to go back, you have to take a lot of stuff out of the way. Mm-hmm. The road is overgrown. It has mm-hmm. rubble in it. It has mm-hmm. all sorts of different...
Weeds and potholes,
exactly. Mm-hmm. So it has to be cleared away to even go back to the first things. Mm-hmm. And I think chapter 15 is trying to start that attempt of going back to just the most basic thing of, you know, who is God? So we can turn there unless people have more comments on this interlude in between part one and part two. Okay, so chapter 15, God who? Why does the question arise?
Because there are many so-called gods.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There are. Uh-huh. There are many gods.
Because people, you keep hearing people say, well, it doesn't really matter what you call God. It's only just one God. And so it doesn't matter what you call him and what you pray for him. And, you know, yes, it does.
I think he made it very clear what his name was.
Yeah.
Well, it's not just the name, although that's a very important part of it, as this mm-hmm. chapter shows. But it's the identity and the content of who the God is.
Right.
On the first page of this chapter, page 198, it says, if we speak in bland generalities, we may be able to create the very thin illusion that all are serving the same God. Mm-hmm. The real test comes, however, when we examine the details and seek to establish the specific identity of a particular God. We can find the details in the lives of those who serve a particular God, as well as in the literature and history attributed to that God. So sometimes people even may say that they're serving the same God, but their actions and their words show that they have very, very different conceptions of who that God is.
That's like the Crusaders
mm-hmm.
and those, even the Nazis who profess to be Christians.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in order to get back to God, we have to get rid of all the religions, because certain gods, according to their religions, only allow for certain people to be members, you know? Or you have to be... It seems to me that the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and I'm talking about the completed God through Yeshua, not completed God, but completed thought through Yeshua, through salvation, is the only God who allows everyone to come, everyone to join, regardless of station, regardless of position, regardless of ethnicity, color, creed, race, religion, sex, anything. All the other ones have all these restrictions on who can be a member of their God, except for ours.
You mean we didn't invent equal opportunity in this country?
Amazing. But I think, and especially when you look, when you go through and you see where it talks about Islam, it talks about Judaism, it talks about all these other gods, you know, Buddha, everybody, it's just, you have to get all the religiousness out of it so that you can focus on who God is and his majesty and his enormity and his mystery.
In ancient times, I think this was both clearer and more confused, because you had lots of gods and people were very explicit about it. There are some scripture references here talking about gods of silver, gods of gold, wood, stone, the gods of Egypt, the gods of the Amorites, Aram, Sidon, Moab, the gods of the Philistines, Hamath, Arpad, and so forth and so on. Every people had its gods. So it was a natural question back then, which God do you serve? people understood that question. Nowadays, people don't understand that question as much.
And if they do, they're insulted.
Mm-hmm. Right. But that's, in some ways, a biblical perspective. And in the Exodus story, God makes himself known to the Egyptians as the God of the Hebrews. That's how he decides to be identified, just as there were gods of Egypt and there were gods of other peoples. And he says that he's the God of the Hebrews. And so keeping in mind that biblical perspective, as it says here, when we talk about serving God, it is important to specify which God we mean. This is not a religious question. It is a question of authority, values, mm-hmm. and goals. So how does the God revealed in the Bible identify himself? Who is he? How does he distinguish himself from all the other gods to whom people bow down? Only after we know the specific identity of this particular God can we answer the question, what does God require? That is the question that those who seek to serve him must ask. In the first chapter of the Bible, God is introduced as the creator and sustainer of all. So I think this is one of the most fundamental questions of human existence. Does God exist? And if he does, who is he? So let's start. Who is God? Well, one way to discover an answer would be to look at how he describes himself in the Bible, which claims to be from God. So how is God described in the Bible itself?
By the four-letter name.
Yeah, there's a few different ways that are discussed in this chapter. One of them is the name of God, which is the four Hebrew letters, Yod-Heh, Vav-Heh, often called the Tetragrammaton, which apparently, according to this chapter, appears in about 6,000 verses in its full form, which is quite a lot.
Yes.
I mean, it's unbelievable how common it is, in a sense. Not common in the sense of opposition to holy, obviously, but regularly occurring in the scriptures. And then several thousands of times more in shortened form. So this is something to think about when you read in English translations. Whenever it has Lord or God in capital letters, it's actually the name of God. And some translations now actually instead do something different, like Shuchaki here puts IHVH with Adonai on top, or some translations will put the Hebrew letters themselves to show the importance of this, because the actual name is not being communicated by the translation and can't really be communicated by the translation. What is God's name?
I think the exact pronunciation has gotten lost over the centuries, but Yahweh or Jehovah have been suggested as possible names.
Right. But with regard to the pronunciation, certainly the pronunciation has been lost, but even though there are those with certainty as to how the name is pronounced, they do not agree with each other, and at least 19 different pronunciations have been given.
Yeah.
So maybe that's not even the best place to start with the pronunciation. We're at a handicap if we don't know the pronunciation of a name. Sorry?
Pronunciation.
He's correcting your...
Oh, you're correcting my pronunciation of pronunciation. Thank you, Fred.
Fred has a theory on how Jehovah is supposed to be pronounced and why. From the biblical Hebrew.
I'm just guessing.
What's your guess, Fred? Explain it to us.
Future, present, and past all combined together with the verb of being. So that would be, the Yud is the future, and the Hey Vav is like the Hove, the present, and the ending is like a past ending with a Hey on the end. Yehovah, maybe. I don't know. It's not Jehovah.
Yehovah. But it's a good theory.
Yeah, and a lot of the, people in the past, sort of like if something starts with J, it's sort of like a hint that it started in Y before that. But right. I can't say I really know.
Okay, but don't go anywhere yet. You notice that when Fred was asked to give us his theory of how the name should be pronounced, he didn't begin with his pronunciation. What did he begin with?
The letters.
The explanation.
The meaning mm-hmm. that he sees mm-hmm. Inscribed in the letters.
Right.
And that's one of the main points of this chapter, that the meaning is actually what's more really being communicated. It's more than the pronunciation. It's more than just well, in Russian, klitschka, like a nickname. It's more than just like a group of syllables that you would, a group of sounds that you would use to call somebody by.
But it also is scriptural, because God is the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow. So the fact that his name would reflect that makes sense.
Sure, but it reflects that, and it reflects...
who he is.
Right, it reflects some other things, too.
They would make a cult out of it, and people do make cults out of it.
Mm-hmm. Right, and that's described in this chapter as well, that some people have focused excessively on how the name, how they think the name should be pronounced.
Mm-hmm.
Does anyone want to discuss that? I mean, there was a passage in this chapter that explained why we don't really know the pronunciation of the name. Maybe we should deal with that a little bit.
Yeah, that'd be good.
I think this is mainly on pages 200 and 201. Can anyone give us a brief summary of that story? And then we'll go on to consider more in depth the meaning of the name itself.
Where it starts with Elijah?
I think it starts a little before that, but there is a point that's being made with those biblical quotations, which is simply that people did pronounce the name of God previously, and you can see this from various scriptures. So they knew it. They knew how it was pronounced. And the Talmud also says that in earlier times, men greeted each other in the name of the Lord, which would mean that they knew the name of the Lord and how it was supposed to be pronounced. So what follows that introduction? What happened between then and now?
The Talmud?
Well, the Talmud here, the only quotation from the Talmud that I see here confirms that people used to speak in the name of the Lord. They used to say it. But something happened from that point on.
Oh, it's in one of the books between the Testaments.
Okay.
Between
the Testaments. We just discussed the fact that there aren't any Testaments.
Well, you know, between the cup. Well, you know, in the ancient Middle Ages.
One of the advantages of this class, or disadvantages, depending on how you look at it, is that you lose the ability to speak coherently. So what were you saying, Fred?
It was in one of the books around 200 B.C. or 300
right,
B.C.
Exactly.
The Wisdom of Sirach?
Yes.
Somebody mentions it?
Mm-hmm.
The Wisdom of Sirach, yeah.
What's mentioned there?
Oh, that the sacred name wasn't meant to be said anymore. People were using it in vain, so they just put a stop to it.
Right. It says specifically not to utter the name of the Holy One. Do not form the habit of uttering the name of the Holy One. And essentially, Judaism has carried forward this idea that in order to avoid taking the Lord's name in vain, you simply don't say it at all. That wasn't the original practice, though, but that's one reason why the pronunciation has been lost. Another reason that's given here is that really the only evidence we have of how it may have been pronounced that would include the vowels, not just the consonants, comes from Greek, and we all know how reliable Greek transliterations are, don't we? After having gone through the first part of this course.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus is one example of that. Could you use Jesus, the English transliteration of a Greek transliteration of Hebrew, to tell you how the original Hebrew was pronounced?
Well, it's a far cry to go from Yeshua to Jesus.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's hard to do. You might be able to do it if you knew what, if you could work backwards and you knew what sorts of rules might be followed.
Last night.
Dramatic.
But it's not a reliable way of determining how the name used to be pronounced. And also there are several different versions in Greek sources. So basically that's the situation that we're in. And the parallel is given to the Essene community. We don't really know what that name means either, partly because we only have it in Greek. And different scholars posit that different, you know, one or another Hebrew words are behind it. 18 or 19 proposed explanations of a term, which must undoubtedly be of Hebrew etymology, according to Edersheim. So there's another example of a term that we have in Greek, but in the original pronunciation in Hebrew is much debated and probably unknowable at this point. So that's essentially why this chapter does not concern itself so much with the pronunciation of the name as with what the name is. What is in a name? What is a name?
A reputation.
Identifies you.
Yeah.
Identifies you and shows characteristics of yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think exactly. It's an identifier and it's an expression of characteristics, at least in the Hebrew sense. I think in most languages it's like that too, in some deep sense. In other words, again, it's not just a combination of sounds to allow us to distinguish one thing from another, but it expresses something about what it describes. At least that's how biblical names operate. So I think Bobby was saying also reputation. It has something to do with your reputation, what you are able to do. Even at the Tower of Babel, this was recognized in Genesis 11. Let us build a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens so that we may make a name for ourselves and not be scattered over the face of the whole earth. So it wasn't that they didn't have names yet. They had names. They called each other by names. They weren't talking in that strictly literal sense of what the word means in English. They meant that their accomplishment would give them a reputation over the whole earth.
How do you interpret Yad Vashem?
What do you mean, how do I interpret it?
Well, it's Shem in that aspect can mean like a memorial.
Yeah, that's why it's used for the Holocaust memorial. Yeah.
Like a helping hand.
And the original appearance of it is in Isaiah, right? Mm-hmm. Where he says, God says he will give a name and a memorial better than sons and daughters to the eunuchs who serve him. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Is that where it appears? Yeah. So, yeah.
That's right.
But it's really, but what does it mean literally, though, Yad Vashem?
Hand and name.
Yeah, a hand and a name. Yeah. So, that's very interesting. Are there other examples of why a name is, or what a name is, or why it's more than simply the sound that you identify someone with?
Well, in Hebrew, you have an expression like Shem Ra and Shem Tov, a good reputation, a bad reputation.
Right. A good name is more to be desired than riches.
Yeah.
Because those phrases, again, you're translating them with the broader meaning, a good reputation, but it's literally a good name.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't mean like a name, you know, it doesn't mean that John sounds better than, you know, Jimmy or something like that.
Uh-huh. When many Hebrew names actually had meanings.
Right.
Of course. A good characteristic ascribed to you would be a good reputation for your name. It's all the same.
Even my name in English, Robert, has meaning. Supposed to, we looked it up the other day, it was a bright flame.
Something like that, yeah.
So I'm a bright flame. Not sure what that means.
It's related to red hair.
Oh, that was so low. But again, Herta, the name Herta is related to home and hearth. Now, that certainly ascribes who she is as Miss Hospitality, but, I mean, and clearly the biblical names all had meanings, and people were given names and renamed because of the meanings of the name.
Two men for each other, a flame inside of a heart.
<There you go. laughs> I always thought it was a cold ember until I met you.
Oh, lovely points.
Yes.
I was lost, though, when you said a hand, a name.
Right.
You said that was interesting, and it just blew right over my head.
Well, okay. Well, I think Fred was introducing that as a similar point to, you know, this whole idea of how a name is not just a combination of sounds, but it has content and it implies reputation and so forth. So Yad Vashem is the name of the Holocaust memorial in Israel. And that's what it means. It means a memorial. And it comes from this biblical passage where God says that he will give to eunuchs who have no children Yad Vashem, a hand and a name, more than sons and daughters, better than sons and daughters. So what does that mean? Well, if you have sons and daughters, you have hands, you know, to do work, to build the family name. You have a name that is expressed in what your family does. You get a reputation. It carries, exactly. It carries on through the generations. So Yad Vashem symbolizes something more than a physical hand and a simple name. It symbolizes your legacy. And so God is saying that he'll give a legacy and a reputation to these people because they've devoted themselves to him, and it will be, in a sense, a spiritual name, a spiritual reputation that is worth more than even the physical reputation that would carry on through one's descendants. Does that make sense?
The last portion didn't to me. The name itself meant more, or...
Well, what God will give them is more than just the physical descent. That's how I understand it, at least. But the point here is somewhat of a linguistic one, that what Shem, name, means in Hebrew is not just, you know, Bobby or Herta or Isaiah. It's something much more meaningful than that.
Past, present, and future implication.
American Indians portrayed it very well, you know. You hear it in Hawaiian names, you know. A person gains a new name sometimes by his reputation. Like when he fights with bears, when, you know, flies with the wind, you know.
You're doing Yiddish too, schmuck. I only know Yiddish.
Well,
that's a bad word.
Yeah, it actually is in Yiddish.
Very bad.
In any event, that's part of what's described here. For example, Jacob's name, it says at a certain point, your name is no longer Jacob, it will be Israel. You will be called Israel. Did he stop being called Jacob after that?
No.
No, he still had the name Jacob. But Israel expressed something about his identity, who he was in relationship to God, actually. And that was carried on through his descendants. Interestingly enough, the same thing applies to Yeshua. Mm-hmm. Isaiah 7:14, the virgin will be with child and will give birth to a son, and they will call him Emmanuel, which means God is with us. Mm-hmm. And
Jacob has a good and a bad meaning. People always look at the bad part of the meaning of Jacob, but all Jacob means is somebody who trails after.
Mm-hmm.
When the Messiah called the disciples, he said, follow after me. That's what following is, Okev.
Mm-hmm.
So he's a follower.
Right.
It could be used in a derogatory sense, one that clings to heels, you know, whatever. But it doesn't necessarily have to be a bad name. But
sure.
God amplified the name in saying Israel, and he was making the good part of Jacob, you know, to follow.
Well, I don't think God saw it as a bad name, because often he calls himself the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob.
Yeah, of course.
But Jacob also acquired this new name of Israel. Now, interestingly enough, the same thing applies to Yeshua. That prophecy from Isaiah is quoted in Matthew, and it goes along with a statement from the angel to Joseph, actually, that Miriam will give birth to a son, and you are to give him the name Yeshua, because he will save his people from their sins. Now, if his name is supposed to be Emmanuel, why is he now given the name Yeshua?
Because God seems to deal with multiple names.
Apparently so, yes. Because the name, again, doesn't just symbolize this simple label. it's something more than that. It's a deeper identity and purpose. Nowhere in Matthew or anywhere else in the Messianic writings is Yeshua called Immanuel by anyone. Matthew makes no attempt to explain this discrepancy because it was not a discrepancy for him. Immanuel, i.e. God with us, is who Yeshua is. That is his name, not in the sense of a label, but in the sense of identity. That is the core of who he is. And the same thing applies to other passages in Isaiah that give names to them, to Mashiach. His name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. So this was not what he was called every day out on the street by his friends, but that was his name in this broader sense, in kind of the way that Fred was talking about Yad Vashem, you know, his memorial, who he really was, the meaning. Of course, Yeshua had that deeper meaning too, the name Yeshua, of salvation.
Mm-hmm.
So this hopefully helps to establish what a name actually is, and we read here of a few other examples that explain this further. Open up in the name of the law.
Yeah.
Well, we have someone here who represents the name of the law. What is the name of the law?
Well, in this case, it's MPD. But, I mean, we don't actually say that, though.
Right. But it doesn't refer to a name.
No.
It refers to the authority and the essence, the content of what the law is.
In the name of Yeshua HaMashiach, rise up and walk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right.
In the authority of Yeshua HaMashiach.
Right. Right. Yeah. So, this is the argument that's presented is that God's name is the same way. That Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh is expressing something about who he is. It's not just a label that we can use to call him. It's not a magical name. It doesn't have magical powers to do things if you pronounce it in the right way. Instead, it's almost an argument of a certain kind. It's a representation of who God is. It's presenting a case for what God is like.
Aren't we taught to close prayer in the name of Yeshua HaMashiach?
Mm-hmm.
No, it's not a magical thing. We're just doing it because of what he did. We're entitled to ask for it because of him.
Right.
Yeah,
in his name.
Yeah, he said, if you ask anything in my name, it will be granted to you.
And it's not a magical formula.